It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. According to the Alzheimer's Association, between the years 2000 and 2008, deaths from Alzheimer's increased by 66%, while every other major cause of death decreased.
By 2050, the incidence of Alzheimer's is expected to quadruple worldwide.
The thought of memory loss among the elderly can be scary, and for children and friends who care for them, the idea can be really overwhelming.
Our next guest is an award-winning poet who took care of her mother for a decade as she passed into dementia. The task was demanding, but she also describes the experience as a gift. Jeannie Murray Walker is a professor of English at Delaware University, and her book is called The Geography of Memory, A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's. Jeannie, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, you call this a pilgrimage. Some people who are caring for people with Alzheimer's think of it as it's treading water. You're in a waiting game, waiting to see what's going to happen. Your life is on hold. But you describe it as a pilgrimage, something that brings to mind the spiritual and also moving forward. Why do you use that word?
For exactly the reasons that you mentioned. For me, I was going through the experience, it was kind of like an endless repetitive slog. Which can be the way it feels when you're, moving in the water, but you don't know exactly which direction or where you're going. It was in looking back that I began to realize that it was actually a journey, or that it was actually a way of moving towards something. I think that part of the problem with Alzheimer's is you can't always tell exactly when it starts. And you certainly don't know the end point, because with each person who experiences the disease, it's different. And so for the caretaker, without any real clear beginning and without any clear end point, it seems like sometimes it's just a repetitive slog. But it is, if you look back at it from several years' vantage point, it's a little easier to see the markers along the way.
Well, it's interesting because you describe it not just as a gift, but at one point you describe it as a spectacular gift that you couldn't have gotten any other way. Tell us a little bit about how you learned to recognize this experience, which a lot of people associate with pain and loss, as a gift.
Well, there were a number of payoffs, I think, and consolations, or you can call them gifts, which is what I did in the book. One of them was that I reconnected with my mother. We had never had a serious break. I just went to graduate school and began, a career and had a family and lived in a different part of the country. And we saw each other twice a year, possibly, or sometimes some years it was only once a year. But I began to see her a lot more frequently when it was clear that she was having some trouble with her paying her bills, for example, and keeping track of items around the house. I began to fly to visit her, and ultimately I used to go sometimes six times a year, and I would spend 5 days at a time with her, a long weekend. So I reconnected with my mother. And that was just really wonderful. I think if that hadn't happened, I'd have always wondered a bit what she was all about. Because in many ways we had quite different ideas and different senses of what the world was like. For starters, she didn't want me to read. She used to say when I was a teenager reading all the time, "You will come to no good."
And now you're a poet and a professor.
Yeah. Well, that made it easy to separate from her. All I had to do was love Shakespeare. But one of the other gifts that I got was reconnecting with a sister. And again, my sister lived in the same city as my mother lived in. And again, I did not have any quarrel with her at all. It's just that we had both gone in our own direction. She became the head of the volunteer center in Dallas. And of course, I've got this career writing in a whole different part of the country in Philadelphia. And so every time I went to Dallas to see my mother, I saw my sister. And my mother became a project for the two of us. I mean, we collaborated. When I was looking back, when I finally got the idea of writing this book, we had we exchanged over 1,000 emails and many, many, many phone calls, and strategized and chose doctors and argued a lot, frankly, but ultimately came to a very deep understanding and bond. And that was truly wonderful. And then another thing that was, you might call a gift, is when you're taking care of somebody who's slowing down, even an aged parent, it doesn't have to be somebody with dementia, you have to walk more slowly, you have to slow down, you don't get as many chances to be on email or Facebook or whatever it is. Well, I was with my mother. I didn't do any of that stuff. She didn't have a connection in her facility. And so I was forced to slow down. And slowing down in that way, I think, caused me to pay more attention to everything from the way food tasted to the way flowers look, to the way things grew, to my mother, you know, and my sister. So, yeah, I did gain some wonderful things, which I still have. And I think it's one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try to change the Alzheimer's discussion a little bit, because I think it's perhaps a little more grim than, in fact, was my experience of it.
You tell a story at the beginning of the book about going to your mother's house and realizing that her freezer was completely stocked with ham, and she didn't eat ham. Was that sort of the beginning of your acknowledgement that maybe something wasn't right, and the beginning of what would become this long journey?
Yeah, I think that was. You just pick up an increasing tempo of these things that are not like your parent. And somewhere along the way, I had that realization. It might have been then. There were also disorganized drawers. My mother was she was a nurse, and she was the kind of person who'd line up paper clips in her drawer. And when you look in the drawer of somebody like that, and it's total chaos, you say, what's going on? But we, of course, didn't ever get a diagnosis. So although she was in an Alzheimer's unit, you know, you have to kind of put two and two together, and it's hard to remember when I go back exactly what it was when I said something is really seriously wrong.
Usually people think about Alzheimer's, and it seems to be the gradual slipping away of the personality that you knew, the person who knew how to do things in a certain way and that you associate, you know, with mom or with dad. But in your book, you talk about actually getting to know your mother sort of more deeply than you might have done before, and also getting to know yourself more deeply. How did that happen?
Well, I viewed my mother's strange comments in the way that you might view a theater script. I had known her well enough as a child and an adolescent so that I knew what she was thinking about and how she talked at different stages of her life. And she seemed like characters that she had been before, so that although she didn't always make sense in the environment that we were in at the time, I could kind of connect what she was saying with her past. And I really read a lot of what she said as metaphor.
And what about you? So you got to know the way she talked and you understood these former selves of her. But what about you? How did it teach you to get reintroduced to yourself, and especially a younger self?
Well, when she would talk as if she was 40 years old, then I would have been maybe 12 at the time or something, you know, and so I would be thrust back into those periods. And I began to remember some of my own history, which I had never really taken time to reflect on. And I might have been able to do that if I had had more time, but it was really the presence of my mother's past selves that allowed me to kind of re-inhabit some of my own old selves. And so I remembered these events that had happened to me, and it really shone a light on my own personal development.
Well, we're talking right now with Jeannie Murray Walker, an award-winning poet and professor of English at the University of Delaware. We're talking about her book called The Geography of Memory, about her mother's passage into dementia. And she says that while this was difficult, it was also a gift. And we'd like to hear your thoughts. What has your experience been taking care of a friend or a parent with Alzheimer's? What was that like for you? Were you able to see a silver lining in the midst of all the loss and the struggle? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
In just a moment, we'll take a look at the headlines. Then we'll be back and hear some of your stories caring for someone with dementia. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back with poet and University of Delaware English professor Jeannie Murray Walker. We're talking about her new memoir of her mother's passage into dementia called The Geography of Memory. And Murray Walker says it was, of course, difficult taking care of her mother, but she's also talking about some of the gifts that she got along the way. And we'd like to hear your thoughts.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you taken care of someone with dementia? A parent, maybe. 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
And let's go right to the phones. We have Teresa joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Therese.
Good afternoon. I helped my dad take care of my mother for 7 years, both when she was at home and then after when she went into a nursing home. And while I understand your guest's perspective about gifts, I think most of the people I've talked to who've dealt with this is we're talking about a lot of stress. We're talking about care issues and inadequate care for in-home and nursing home care. We're talking about financial issues. We're talking about the emotional stress. Alzheimer's manifests itself differently in different people. You know, you've got some people with wandering issues, others who are not able to speak, which was one of my mother's first symptoms, not finding words, and then very early losing speech. So I would say that overall, it's a very stressful and difficult disease. It's fortunate when you're able to get a few, but I really think that it's a devastating disease for families, and that cannot be overlooked. And many people who have parents that are far away don't have the luxury of traveling that frequently to see them, and then there's the added stress of being far away. So I do really appreciate the perspective, and I did experience a few gifts along the way, but I would say by and large, there's no other way to cut it except to say devastation. And what our generation, my generation, the baby boom generation, our kids are in for if we don't find a cure, I think is unknown to the public at large.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your thoughts, Therese. And Therese talking about that it is devastating and there's no way around it, even if we look for and sometimes find gifts, this is a hard road.
It sure is. It's a very complex story. And I think the narrative that I tell in The Geography of Memory registers all those terrible dilemmas that Therese is talking about. The problem of finding caretakers, the problem of watching your parent, sort of not exactly disintegrate. It's the holding together of the personalities, you know, that seems to be disintegrating, and the grief that involves. It's really, I think, pretty clear in almost all the books written about Alzheimer's how devastating it is. And I think it also has the power to blow families to smithereens. The siblings quarrel because they get exhausted and they do have financial problems and issues. At some points, I think for some of us, we have to either use the money to send our kids to college or to take care of our parents. And it's an awful choice. So all of that is in the book. I wanted to see if I could also introduce some of the things that happen to us which can be gifts. So it's a complex story to tell.
Well, how did you deal with some of those stresses that were there, you know, despite the things that you found that were sustaining? There was, you know, anytime someone has Alzheimer's, there's a lot there that is going to take a toll. How do you suggest that people cope with some of the stresses and the pain that goes along?
Well, if you can work it out with your sibling, it helps a lot. I think it's harder to be an only child. The two of us, there were two of us, two sisters, did not always agree. In fact, we had some incredible arguments, which are, you know, told about, and the book tells about those. But in the end, the two of us together were able to develop a bond because we were, I think, careful of our relationship and worked it out together. And that bond has survived. The other thing that we did that I think maybe helped us was we got our kids involved. Both my sister and I had, each of us had two children, and they came. Sometimes they weren't so crazy about it, but they came and helped with the moving. They came. It was fantastic to have that younger generation helping us. It was great for our spirits, I think.
Well, I want to get one more call in. We've only got a couple of minutes left here. Let's go to Lynn in Boulder Junction. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi.
What is your story?
I would like to say that I understand and I appreciate what the previous callers are saying about how difficult it is, and especially for in our experience of dealing with my father in the early stages where there's the anger issues, with the loss of control and the losing the driving privileges. That was difficult to deal with. And then and trying to reason with someone, it just doesn't work. But we went to the support group meetings, and they were wonderful. And I think I have to say we had a great time. We laughed a lot. We looked for the humor in everything, and just the sheer joy of, you know, spending that time, and whether, you know, you might lose the intelligence and that sort of tracking, but you don't lose your feelings and you don't lose your heart. It was one of my greatest privileges.
Okay. Thank you so much for your thoughts, Lynn. And Jeannie, what would you say in the last minute or so to the experience that Lynn had?
Well, I love that. I mean, I think that also she sort of encapsulated what happened with us. We laughed a lot. Actually, the book is quite funny. And I think part of it has to do with the disconnects. I learned when I was with my mother to just take it as given. If she said we were on an elevator to the 17th floor, I pressed the button to the 17th floor, you know. And that makes everything lighter than it would be if you were trying to reason her back, no, we're standing in your kitchen, Mother.
Well, Jeannie, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us and for being here today.
It's been a pleasure.
That was Jeannie Marie Walker, award-winning poet and professor of English at the University of Delaware. And you can continue the conversation, maybe share your own experience on the Central Time Facebook page. Jeannie's book is called The Geography of Memory.
Coming up next is the news, and then we'll get an update on legislation in Wisconsin that aims to raise the maximum speed limit on some highways to 70 miles an hour. Stick around, there's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin is now one step closer to a higher speed limit. A bill that would increase the state speed limit to 70 miles per hour in some areas cleared the Assembly Transportation Committee and now goes to the full Assembly for a vote.
And our next guest is in favor of that change. We're joined now by John Bowman, Communications Director for the National Motorists Association. John, welcome to Central Time.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So why raise the speed limit to 70 miles an hour here in Wisconsin?
Well, there are several reasons why you would want to do that. First of all, if you look at what surrounding states are doing here in the Midwest, virtually all of Wisconsin's neighbors have either raised up their speed limits to 70 miles per hour or are in the process of doing it. And if you actually go back and look at the highway fatality rates in those states, you'll find that they're actually lower than they are here in Wisconsin. So there is, believe it or not, there is a safety benefit to raising speeds up to their safe and appropriate levels. And so that's what Wisconsin would be doing here. So there's definitely a safety benefit to it, as well as some other convenience and efficiency benefits associated with raising the speed up.
Is Wisconsin comparable in terms of the way that its roadways are structured? I'm just thinking, you know, Minnesota is sort of a plain state. There's a lot of ground to cover. Illinois is flat. Is Wisconsin similar?
In terms of how its interstates and major freeways are structured and engineered, it certainly is. If you go back to when the interstates were built, 40, 50 years ago, you'll find that throughout the country they were, in fact, engineered and built to tolerate speeds of 70 to 75 miles per hour. So, in fact, they've probably gotten safer since then, certainly. Vehicle technology and design has improved. So really, the roads can handle it throughout the country, and certainly the vehicles can as well.
Now, we covered this topic before, this proposal, when we first heard about it here on Central Time. And judging by the feedback we got on the Facebook page, some callers, the number one concern people have is safety. Now, if we raise the speed limit, are we sacrificing safety for convenience?
Actually, if you look at studies and you look at what happens in the real world, when speed limits go up like this, you actually find that it reduces accidents. And the reason for that is that when you raise speed limits up to their safe and appropriate levels based on traffic engineering standards, what you're doing is you're decreasing the speed variability among vehicles on the road, which is the cause for most vehicle conflicts and accidents. So for many years, we have had highway speeds that have been sort of artificially depressed, and now when we're getting them back up to where they should have been set all along, we're actually in the process of increasing highway safety. It sounds a little counterintuitive, but if you look at what happens in other states, for example, in Utah a few years ago, they raised a stretch of interstate up to 80 miles an hour from 75 miles per hour, and people had safety concerns. What happened, in fact, was really nothing. The speeds that people actually drove on that highway didn't change, and there was no increase in accidents or in fatalities. So it really does have a safety benefit when you do it the right way.
What about the concern that, you know, right now the speed limit's 65, and so therefore people usually, you know, drive 75, and if you make it 70, people will drive 80, 85?
Mm-hmm.
Or do people regulate themselves?
Yeah, people do regulate themselves, and that's really a good way to look at it. Again, when they've done studies and when they look at the speeds that people actually travel on the highways, they find that people reach a limit that is both safe and comfortable for them, no matter what the posted speed is. So people's travel speeds tend to be independent of the actual posted speed. So on a highway, let's say like I-94 between Milwaukee and Madison, you could raise the speed limit up to 85 or 90, not that you ever would, and you wouldn't find that people's travel speeds would really change all that much, simply because they wouldn't feel safe going those higher speeds.
Now, there was a Democratic representative who suggested amending the bill to include stiffer penalties for things like distracted driving and not wearing a seatbelt. If the speed limit goes up, should these penalties go up too?
Well, we've reviewed that. We've also reviewed the original bill, of course, and our organization supports the intent of the original bill. We'd like a little bit more time to kind of go through the amendments. They just came out in the last day or two. Our preference would be to sort of keep those issues separate from the speed limit bill. Quite frankly, there are already in place penalties for inattentive driving and for seatbelt violations. So we would probably just want to let those stand as they are.
Now, you mentioned efficiency and said this would be more efficient if the speed limit was raised. How exactly would that work, and wouldn't we be using more gas?
Well, again, what you have to keep in mind is that people are already going those speeds. If you've ever driven on the interstate, you know, between, again, here and Milwaukee or Madison and Twin Cities or whatever, you find that people are already going those speeds. So you wouldn't expect to see much of an increase, in actual travel speeds. What you would see, though, is by getting speed limits posted appropriately, is that you would see more of the slower drivers on the road actually increasing their speeds to match that of traffic around them. And in so doing, you're increasing traffic flow, you're decreasing bottlenecks, you're decreasing conflicts between and among vehicles. So you are actually increasing highway efficiency and in some regards helping with fuel usage, because you're decreasing the amount of stopping and starting, fast accelerations, quick lane changes. All of those contribute to fuel usage.
Now, I want to go back to the safety question for a moment. And you said that from what we've seen in other states, it hasn't resulted in highways that are less safe. But what about drunken driving? Now, if we raise the speed limit and we have someone who's driving drunk, doesn't that mean that, you know, just simple physics and impact is harder when you're going faster? More people would die.
Well, simple physics is always in play. And certainly vehicles traveling at higher rates of speed do have a greater impact when they strike other vehicles. Overall, though, when you set the speed limits correctly, you actually reduce the number of vehicle conflicts and therefore reduce the total number of accidents on the road. So it does have a preventative effect. Again, it sounds a little counterintuitive, but if you can reduce the overall number of accidents on highways, I would say that is the primary safety benefit. And when they do this in other states, that's what happens. So we see it as a safety benefit.
But would those accidents that did happen, would they be more likely to have fatalities?
It is possible. If you're already going at that speed, like I say, most people aren't going to change their driving habits very much because of this, and I'm not really sure that someone who is driving impaired on the highway is going to be paying a whole lot of attention to the speed limit anyways. I think studies have shown that that's not necessarily the case. So I don't think you're going to see much difference in the overall accident rates. If anything, they're going to improve.
So, John, if this bill becomes law, do you have an idea of how soon the change is going to take effect?
I don't know the details on that. I would imagine that the Wisconsin DOT, as well as the legislative people looking at this, would have a better sense of that. That could even be kind of up in the air right now, since the bill has not passed the full House. And from there, it would need to go through the whole Senate process, probably being reviewed in at least one committee, if not two or more. So changes could take place between now and when the bill is eventually passed into law.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking to John Bowman, the communications director for the National Motorists Association. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
Our next guest has been called a rock star of graphic design, among other things. He's created about a zillion book covers, and now he's sharing some advice on creating visual design and appreciating design in the world around us.
Chip Kidd is with us. He's an author, a designer. His new book is Go, A Kid's Guide to Graphic Design. Chip, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, reading your book, I realized there's something dangerous about thinking about design because you just start to see it everywhere. And it is everywhere, isn't it?
Yes, and I don't think there's any danger in that.
So where do we, I mean, anything you write that isn't natural, it was designed by someone. That's a different way to think about the world that we don't pay attention to that much.
Well, I think, you know, I think it helps to pay attention to it. I mean, you have to consider that somebody has to figure everything out, and there's no reason to take that for granted. And sometimes when people don't think figure things out very well, it can be rather catastrophic.
Now, even if we're not pros and we don't do this for a living, is it useful for us to think about design and work it into our lives?
I definitely think so. And I mean, everybody designs their life, whether they realize it or not, from what they wear to how they interact with coworkers or their friends or their family. I mean, that is design. And I know I'm getting a little egg-heady here. The book itself is really more about getting kids or any other kind of novice to graphic design to sort of think about what it is and what makes it up and what the components are, and then think about how to make it for themselves.
Well, let's get into that. I mean, I'm a novice, not a kid. There are a lot of kids who do better graphic design than I do. What are some of the basic tools if we're designing, I don't know, a PTA flyer or a sign or a logo or a for sale sign? What are some good tools we can use to make it pop a little more than we might on our first try?
Well, I think one thing you have to think about is clarity, actually. And you're saying a PTA flyer. What you know, hierarchies of importance, of information. What do you want your audience to see first when they see this PTA flyer? Do they want to see what day and time it is first? Do they want to see where it's being held first? You know, I think these are kinds of considerations to make when you're, you know, and that's a very sort of pragmatic piece of design. There's a sort of example I have in the book of about, you know, how do you design something to help somebody get out of a building right away if they need to, which is, of course, an exit sign. And the point being, you don't need something like that to be extremely elaborate or decorative or even, you know, extravagantly colored. What you need for it to be is very immediate and very recognizable and very understandable about where and how to leave a building. So something like a PTA flyer would be similar to that. Whereas there's no reason to make something like that overly decorative. You just need to be able to get your message out in the clearest, most concise way possible.
Do you think that's a stumbling block for some people? They try to make something that's really very functional and try to make it too ornate or pretty or complicated?
Well, you know, you'd have to take it as a case-by-case basis, but I certainly see examples of that all the time. I don't know if you do, but I'm sure that happens all the time.
Let's get into some of the tools. A lot of your book, as you mentioned, is a lot of different tips on things to try in graphic design. One of them you talk about is scale, big versus
yes.
Small. How do you use that contrast to best advantage?
Well, again, it all depends on what the problem is, and defining the problem helps you to more easily define the solution. And again, scale and big and small are all relative things. So what you start with is what you call your picture plane, which is, let's say it's 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, and I'm just thinking out loud here. You've lost your cat, and you want to get him back desperately. So you would want to make the picture of the cat as relatively large as you can, so that that people can more easily recognize him. And that's just common sense. But then, if you're going to put little tabs at the bottom so that people can call you, those are going to be relatively small, because you're going to have a lot of them, and you're going to rip one of them off to use the phone number. So, I mean, there's just a kind of very pragmatic example of you know, comparing large and small on the same page. But again, we're only talking about 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. If you have a lot of money and you're totally desperate, you can rent a billboard, and then that's something else entirely.
You really want that cat?
Yep.
So you've done a lot, over 1,000, I think we actually said zillions, we rounded up a little, of book designs. Talk us through your process. Like, how do you take a book and then figure out what the cover needs to look like?
You read it. You read the manuscript, and you just kind of take it from there, and you let the author basically guide you. But again, like I did a talk on for TED about this, and I don't want to overlap with that, because anybody can go online and see that, where I talk a lot about this in terms of specifically designing book covers. But you act as a translator. You act as an interpreter and a translator of the author's text into a visual icon.
All right. Well, let's go deeper into the toolkit now. You also write about using light and dark contrast. What are some tricks of the trade? And it doesn't matter if it's a particular, you know, sign or anything like that, but what are some of the ways we can use light and dark in our design?
Well, I mean, if you're dealing with typographic information, do you want to use a dark background with light type, or do you want to use a light background with dark type? If you're dealing with text on the written page, as you probably know, you want a white or off-white page, and you want dark type for because if you print an entire book the other way around, it's just going to strain your eyes. It's just not going to be good for you. Conversely, if you're driving down the highway and you're trying to find which way to go, there's a reason that highway signage has a relatively dark background and light letters, which of course are also very reflective for evening. And that's because you're only concentrating on a very small but very important amount of information. And in that case, a dark background with a light type works better. You know, also similarly, think of movie credits.
Oh, yeah. They're almost always light on dark.
It's always light on dark. But you wouldn't want to read a novel that way.
True. Very true. Well, I'm looking in your book right now, Positive and Negative Space. You use the FedEx logo as a successful use of negative space with that arrow hidden in amongst the letters.
Yes. Brilliant.
Why does that pop like it does?
Well, what's kind of wonderful about that is that it's there if you see it, but if you don't see it, it doesn't really matter. But it's just kind of a wonderful sort of subconscious, subliminal thing of, you know, not only is it an arrow, it's an arrow going from left to right. So where the E of FedEx meets the X of FedEx, the negative space makes an arrow that implies that they are going to be taking your package and successfully getting it from point A to point B. Another, I think, wonderful use of negative space that I cite earlier in the book in the history of graphic design is the a logo for Obama, the way inside it, the sun is rising over the horizon.
Right. Some people have said we're entering an age where images are becoming like a language. With that in mind, any advice on getting the most out of an image we use to send a message?
Well, first of all, I don't think that's changed. You know, the first graphic design was the cave paintings at Lascaux in 15,000 BC, and those were purely pictures. So in that sense, this is kind of old news. I'm not quite sure what the question is, but if you do a lot of traveling, especially to foreign countries that don't speak English, you'll see increasingly the signage is all in pictograms, so that it, no matter where you're from, you're able to read it. And I think that that's a good thing.
All right, in our last 30 seconds or so, Chip, you end with homework assignments. What's something that somebody could try right now to see to get into graphic design?
Oh, my goodness. Homework. That just sounds like no fun at all. I love the assignment of, create a poster that either gets somebody to start doing something or stop doing something. I'm sure there's something in your life that you once started or you once stopped, and think about using graphic design to make that happen.
All right. And, Chip, you're on your way to Wisconsin next week for the Library Association meeting, right?
That is correct. Now, to be more exact, that's October 22. So that's not next week.
Week after.
It's the week after. It's the 23rd, actually,
gotcha.
Wednesday. Green Bay.
All right, Chip, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay. Quickly, can I give you the correct pronunciation of the book?
Go, A Kid's Guide to Graphic Design?
It's go,
gotcha.
A Kid's Guide to Graphic Design.
All right, Chip, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Chip Kidd, author and designer. His new book is Go, A Kid's Guide to Graphic Design.